Thank you for the last two presentations. They play perfectly into the hands of our presentation. Because I'm not an anthropologist by full training, and I'm not a linguist. I'm a media producer and designer, but I have a very strong ongoing relationship with visual anthropology. My PhD was supervised by Alan McFarlane. I worked with him back in the 80s on his Rivers video project, and the media work that I'm producing for my research is working currently with Wendy James on her anthropological archive. So I've been working with anthropological archives and anthropological materials myself for a long time. I've done field work by proxy in the Himalayas and in Indonesia, but I haven't formally signed up and done that field work through anthropology, although Alan was my supervisor at the Royal College of Art, where I studied interface design. So this project, I've been working, it's intermittent work, it's been done around other things over a number of years, and I've been working with proprietary software. This is Director, which goes back quite a long time. I'm waiting for more open source software to catch up with the kind of interfaces and ideas that we've been working with. And the project has had several stages. And it started off with an academic article that was written in response to Wendy's experience of making a film. And in the article, she says that it's about the anthropology of emotion, and it's about this. Wendy's fieldwork is in the Sudan-Ethiopian borderlands. She's been doing fieldwork there since the 1960s. It's an ongoing social history, a history of displacement, a history of civil war, a community that was displaced in the 1980s, has recently been repatriated back to the Sudan to a very volatile situation on the borderlands. There's going to be a vote in January for independence in the southern Sudan. This particular community are just over the border in the north, so are likely to find ongoing problems if the southern Sudan succeeds, and they're in the north because they've been connected, seen by the Sudanese government as being part of the rebel movement. Had Christian church working with them, living with them among that community for a number of years, so this community are seen to be Christian, which is problematic with the current Sudanese government, etc., etc. So there is one of the contemporary contexts that we very clearly want to put on the table today is one of ongoing civil war, what materials in Wendy's archive should be available, accessible, how we make these materials available to the people themselves but without putting people's lives at risk, a huge complex set of issues there. So this was about different ways of talking about fear, different uses in the language, different ways of conceptualizing fear. I transposed this, I used intertitles, and I added film clips from Wendy's recordings. Right since the 60s, she has been recording and documenting using cine, using slides, using audio, then more recently using Hi8 video, mobile phone. When she's in the States working with diaspora communities, she's shown some of these materials to the community and recorded on the mobile phone people's responses. So it's an ongoing project. So that was the first stage. That was relatively straightforward, a fixed text, enriching that text with audiovisual materials. The second stage was a website that is available online, voicesfromthebluenile.org. Oh, look, it's quit again. This is just, we divided it thematically, mostly looking at the semi-permanent refugee camp in Ethiopia just before repatriation, how that community had become semi-permanent, and some of the, there was a sense of stability beginning to emerge, although everybody knew it wasn't a temporary, it was a temporary home, but it was a home for over 10 years. So this material is looking mainly at that. It's supporting Wendy's most recent book on war and survival. It's the third of a trilogy, which is looking at that recent history of displacement. The book looks very much at personal testimony, at how people's lives are torn apart. People get separated through civil war from being on different sides of the fence, but then come together, how it's a fluid and it's a flux situation. And what has motivated me to keep working with Wendy all these years is that right since the 60s, when she first started her field work, Wendy saw this community as a community in flux and not as a static, unchanging community. And in the second book of her trilogy, I just want to read this because I think this is, for me, this is really, really important context. The preface to the paperback edition, she says, it's highly ironical that while academic anthropology has self-consciously tried to move towards a recognition of openness, hybridity and multiplicity in collective and personal identities, the Uruk have been forced by the violent circumstances of the modern world into the straitjacket of a closed community, publicly defined and provided for in terms of national, ethnic and religious identity. They are not alone in their experience of suffering and displacement, nor of being contained and closed in by the modern world. This is moreover a process of which they are, to a substantial degree, properly aware, on which they consciously reflect. I'm now preparing a third volume on their recent history as a testimony to their self-knowledge in this predicament, an account which I hope will find resonance not only in other war zones of Africa, but also more widely. And that's hugely important, that idea, the self-awareness, the testimony, the understanding. And what we're trying to do now, so you can look at this website, it's divided thematically, presents a number of different stories, people's perceptions, with a summary of what's been said, references to the book, and then the video, and it's organised thematically. All of these, apart from the 60s material, are from that period of relative stability in the refugee camp. So that's what that focuses on. Now, our director piece has quit again, so I'm going to just open it up again. So that was all relatively straightforward. That's a closed text. It's fixed in time. It represents a moment when this book was published and the website published to support it. We're now getting into much messier, more complicated territory of the archive. So up to this point, we've been working, it's all in Wendy's attic, it's all in boxes, we've digitised, just put stuff onto video, and we've been working in a very rough and ready way. I've been using my laptop as a bit of a sketchbook in a way, and I've been experimenting with interfaces. So building very much on the last presentation, trying to create poetic interfaces. The teaching I do in Bristol, I'm teaching students new forms of narrative, mosaic-type narratives, the new emerging literacies that we're getting with all this new technology. And this is where it began. From this article, she talked about three different ways of remembering the past, and the three different ways that people remember. The middle ground, the most immediate, where it's very matter of fact, remembering, talking about awful incidents in a very matter of fact way. The middle way, where it's the middle distance, starting to reflect on the trauma, and you can see clear anxiety in Peke as she's talking about the loss of a loved one. And then storytelling, where Nathaniel is spinning a yarn. It happened quite a while ago, so, you know, lest we forget, let's tell a story, I'll tell you this in an entertaining way because it's happened now, but actually we mustn't forget. So this just is an interface to show those different ways. And then it's just a fluid interface, so you can click, you get the subtitles coming up as we get the speaking. How do I turn the sound up? Which is a...
Plugged in to turn the sound over. Take the sound. No, sorry.
Am I in the wrong? Should it be in there?
No, it's just really quiet.
Okay, it's that one. Okay. And the very nice bit, you can go back, and you can go back, and it carries on where you left off. Okay, so very matter-of-fact way, Martha has met Kofi Annan. She is, you know, one of the spokespeople for her community, and Wendy, in her writing, has always tried to let the voices of the people themselves come into her work through written transcription. And so what we're trying to do is we want to now create an archive that where the materials themselves, there's a fluid engagement with those materials, where you can, you don't have to edit to one single line as if you were making a film. We can use multiple windows, we can juxtapose materials, we can create authored pathways through those materials, and in that we can embed some of Wendy's, the context behind it. So I just want to show you how that idea of juxtaposition and the idea with these multiple windows is that I am but one curator of these materials. I'm creating these author pathways, but I'm not putting them into a tightly closed structure. We're just using multiple windows so that other people can author their own pathways in the future with these multiple windows. It doesn't prejudice other uses and other ways of interpreting this archive and other types of aesthetic interface. Paul and I have been working with this one clip of different ways of interpreting that clip. So just in terms of the language analysis, it's very simple, just, you know, going to different sections. Very simple. And so in terms of the navigation, it's all on the keyboard so that you haven't got loads of clutter. You're trying to engage with the materials themselves as far as possible. Then just different ways of, there's Martha again, the same clip, but this time, you know, footage from what the kind of times that she's talking about, you know, the worst times of the journey of displacement.
About 60 miles from Pendida. Fleeing war and famine, over 260,000 Sudanese have come here.
Good. So that's a piece of news footage. Most of these materials are Wendy's. There's a copyright issue there with that because that isn't. So, but Martha appears in that clip, so it is reflexive. I haven't got time to show the whole thing. Then just looking at this idea of the polyphony and bringing the voices through, Wendy has agreed for me to film short video interviews to introduce the archive, to organise the archive chronologically, and by doing that we can look at the changing context of her fieldwork and the changing questions that she was asking over the years, because one thing that's important about the archive is that over the years, the context of her fieldwork has clearly changed as she's become an independent witness documenting the impact of civil war and an occasional consultant with the humanitarian agencies. That wasn't what was anticipated in the 60s as a student of Evans Pritchard, you know, how the fieldwork first started out. And the other point, these materials were originally recorded for research purposes. It's only through time that Wendy's come to be, you know, see the value of the written and the audiovisual for discussing and talking about the work and for analysis. So here, when I filmed Wendy doing an introduction, I then asked her to talk about some of her own memories, just as another way of putting her into the archive as a story, as a character herself, alongside other characters talking about her own memories. So there's a memory from Martha, there's a memory from Wendy, talking about, oh, I remember at one point such and such. Then, this is just aesthetic. This is just making the point that this was me trawling through the archive. I don't know that a computer can ever do this. Just looking at some of the 60s footage of different everyday activities, making coffee, bringing food in, preparing the grinding stone. And then, similar, this is in the refugee camp again, semi-stability, recreating some of those activities. So this is in the 1990s, drinking beer, bringing food in, preparing the grinding stone, and then the facility to juxtapose those. So you can look at memories through time. But that, just to make that little sequence, you know, is a lot of personal endeavour, trawling through, finding those absolute visual analogies. I love doing it, but it's not very practical. You know, it took a long time. Can a computer ever do that, is a question to ask. This is just looking at memories and how a mother and a child make a soundscape, two women together make a soundscape, and then across the village. And then I've recorded her talking about how when she heard this in the refugee camp, it took her back to the 60s. It was a very resonant sound from past times. Pounding, this is just a playful how rhythms are created through pounding, and they're starting to create a rhythm across the stone pocking and the pounding. It's just a different way with the interface where you can create that playfulness yourself through interaction. And then the final thing I wanted to show, this is, we've looked at reflexivity. This is footage from the 60s. This is the audio of that time, Diviner's Dance. And then this is footage of, in the refugee camp, one of the people who Wendy knows well produced the book, her book that she'd given to him a while back from his hut. And they started looking at it, they started looking at the photos and reminiscing on what was in the photos. And what's in the photos is the pictures of the Diviner's Dance. So then, while playing that, I've then recorded Wendy. Okay, the time to show. But so the idea there, with some of the, where there's still, where there's cine, which is silent, you can add the sound, no problem. Sometimes where you've got footage that has sound on it and you then want to add the commentary, you know, there's interface problems to work through, how to deal with sound. But it's just to give you a sense of what we're trying to do to create these engaging poetic interfaces that relate more. We're organising a symposium in Bristol on interactive documentary. It's just really all the ideas that I've been thinking about for over 20 years. Now the technology is really starting to emerge. These kind of interfaces are really coming together now in the kind of documentary making world. So, but the point to make is that ethically, you know, in an era of participation and collaboration and co-creation, it's really important for me to recognise that I'm curating them in one way, but I've got to absolutely make sure that the archive can be used and accessed and curated in other ways by other people in the future as well. And that's where Paul comes in, because working with Paul to develop software and tools using the more open source environments, because this is proprietary, you know, its long-term future is uncertain, and those tools are starting to emerge now, very powerful tools, both for the interface but also for collaborative co-collaboration and all that.
Okay, thank you. So I'm just going to add a little bit onto the end of what Judith has been talking about. And our project together was really starting from the point of view of some of these interfaces that she's created and looking at how the archive could be organised and how the metadata could afford this type of interaction through the interface. We haven't been going that long. We've got a little bit of done a little bit of thinking through it. I just need to switch something there. Isn't it? Can create roots through it. But then the ability to serendipitously find some interesting things that you can put together and explore. And so obviously we need a sort of a metadata system that has whole object metadata on the individual resources, but then also has some timed sequenced metadata for the multimedia aspects. So this is just one example using the Padma software. Padma is an open archive based in India, and they've developed this software, which is based on web standards. And the very interesting thing now is that the web standards have started to catch up with requirements of multimedia. and the HTML5 standard supports video natively, and so you no longer have to use a Flash proprietary software to do interactive work with multimedia. Find my mouse again. So this lets you look at video clips and scan through them, look at the whole object data, and then go through to looking at time data. I can play that. And this is the type of interface that would allow sharing and layering of metadata by different individuals over the web. This is a possibility, becoming a possibility now, as we've seen. The problems we have with this archive, or the questions we have with this archive, include this idea of access and who should be the people who are allowed to do this additional annotation. Back to you.
So, brilliant, perfect. So we're at the point of scoping up how we're going to approach the archiving. So we're also working with a colleague in the Oxford Academy of Documentary Film who's helping Wendy with the basic digitisation and the logging and the catalogue. So at one level, Wendy's using Final Cut Pro. We've now got all the original 60s footage and the Hi8 footage on DBCam. And so Wendy can now sit and she can catalogue it. The question, one of the questions for us is now, at the same point, you know, should we be getting metadata in there? We've been working with a piece of software, or been looking at a piece of software called Frameline 47, which was designed out of the television industry for adding metadata to film rushes. You know, there's a lot of talk now in the television and the audio production industries that producers should be adding metadata to their rushes as part of that process. Again, quite time consuming, you know, lots of issues there. So that's one of them, you know, how to set up a workflow where the metadata is going in at the same time as we're cataloguing. Then the data modeling, what categories, what kind of metadata. You know, there are all these systems that categorise ethnographic materials, but what kind of epistemological structures do they impose? So that's the next layer. You know, what cataloguing system do we use? Do we use free text? Do we have fields? How do we define those? Then we've got the issue of, in the software industry, you have user-led design. You know, how much should we be showing the materials to our potential different audiences? How many different audiences should we be opening this up to? You know, just like you were saying, now it's not good enough. This can't just sit on an academic server somewhere and be a closed world just to academics. The world's changing. There is a definite demand from the people themselves to have access to these materials. We really want them to be able to. But when Wendy shows materials, you know, how much is that a personal, how much is that a closed thing? People want to look at materials but don't necessarily want to do that in a public arena, in a public shared space. So we've got issues over multiple users, multiple curation. You know, at what point should we be opening up the metadata tagging to a wider, the wider community? These are all questions that we're trying to work out before we set up our workflow. And linking to that wider regional context is really important. The baseline, you know, we don't, this Wendy has worked with this community, these particular individuals, for a number of years, but she has also done other work in the region, and we don't want to essentialize. And as I read from here, you know, the Uduk as a community, that they've had to define themselves as that largely to access resources and access aid and to make the way in nation states. But that's not actually, you know, we want to recognize that actually it's a much more fluid community than that. So how we can reflect that in this work. So lots of questions. Any answers, please? Any suggestions?
Thank you very much.